Chapter 4. Signs of Russian reconnoitering, or digital intrusions, as the National Security Agency called them, first appeared in local and state electoral boards' computerized voter registration rolls, lists of voters' names and addresses, in the summer of 2015. The first showed up in Illinois, then spread across the country to include 21 states. As the NSA and FBI picked up more information on these cyber intrusions, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper worried that Russia might use the data to change or manipulate votes in some way. "Is this just Russia?" he wondered. The Russians were always trying to make trouble. Clapper made sure the initial information was included in Obama's President's Daily Brief, PDB, the highest-level top security briefing. Obama read it each day on a pre-programmed iPad, which he returned. Similar iPads were distributed by designated PDB briefers to the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, and the CIA Director, although in these cases, the briefers remained in the room while the principals read the PDB and then reclaimed the iPads. In July of 2016, WikiLeaks and DC Leaks, another site known for releasing hacked government and military materials, began publishing emails taken from a Democratic National Committee server by groups of Russian hackers identified as Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear. Intelligence about Russian meddling caused deep concern in Obama's National Security Council. Over time, the intel got better and more convincing. Should President Obama go on primetime national television and announce these findings? Would it look like he was attacking Trump, linking the Republican nominee with Russia? Could it backfire and look like he was meddling in the U.S. election, trying to tip the scales? To remain silent had its perils. Oh my God, we know about this Russian meddling and we're not acting? We're not telling the public? There could be a backlash directed at Obama and his national security team after the election. In the very unlikely, almost inconceivable chance that Trump won and the intelligence became public, the questions would come. What did they know? When did they know it? And what did they do? John O. Brennan, director of the CIA, argued vehemently against showing their hand. Brennan was protective of the agency's human sources. "Now you see the dilemma," he said, "for him personally and the CIA institutionally. The mantra was always, protect the sources." Yet, he wanted to do something. Brennan needed to speak to his counterpart, Russian FSB intelligence chief Alexander Bortnikov, about Syria and harassment of U.S. diplomats. He asked Obama if he could raise the election meddling issue with Bortnikov. Obama approved the under-the-radar approach. On August 4th, Brennan told Bortnikov, "You're meddling in our election. We know it. We have it cold." Bortnikov flatly denied it. The next day, August 5th, Mike Morrell, who had been deputy CIA director from 2010 to 2013 and twice acting director, published an op-ed in the New York Times. The headline, "I ran the CIA. Now I'm endorsing Hillary Clinton." Morrell accused Trump of being an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. Clapper was chosen to brief the so-called Gang of Eight in Congress, four Republican and Democratic leaders in both the Senate and House, plus the four chairmen and vice chairmen of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. Clapper was stunned by how partisan the leaders were. Republicans disliked everything about the briefing. The Democrats loved every morsel, peppering him with questions about the details and sourcing. He left the briefing dismayed that intelligence was increasingly another political football to kick around. By fall, the intelligence reports showed that Moscow, like almost everyone else, believed that Clinton was likely to win. Russian President Vladimir Putin's influence campaign shifted strategy to focus on undermining her coming presidency. Clapper and Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson were the most anxious to alert the public to the Russian interference. At 3 p.m. on Friday, October 7th, they released a joint statement officially accusing Russia of trying to interfere in the U.S. election, although they didn't name Putin in the public release. The U.S. intelligence community is confident the Russian government directed the recent compromise of emails from U.S. persons and institutions. These thefts and disclosures are intended to interfere with the U.S. election process. Russia's senior-most officials are the only ones who could have authorized the activities. Clapper, Johnson, and the Clinton campaign expected this to be the big news of the weekend, as did the reporters who began working on the story. But 1 hour later, at 4:05 p.m., David Ferenthald at the Washington Post released a story headlined, "Trump recorded having extremely lewd conversation about women in 2005. The Post released an audio outtake recording from the NBC show Access Hollywood of Trump bragging crudely about his sexual prowess. He said he could grope and kiss women at will. "When you're a star, they let you do it," Trump said. "You can do anything. Grab them by the pussy." The Access Hollywood tape was a political earthquake. The Russia story essentially disappeared. "I expected it to be something that would have a lot of currency over the following days," Jay Johnson later said, "and that it would be a continuing conversation with more questions from the press. But the press went off to the other end of the pasture because of greed and sex and groping." Trump issued a brief statement to the Post. "This was locker room banter, a private conversation that took place many years ago. Bill Clinton has said far worse to me on the golf course, not even close. I apologize if anyone was offended." Less than an hour later, at 4:30 p.m., WikiLeaks capped the day's news by dumping thousands of emails hacked from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's personal account online. They revealed excerpts of Hillary Clinton's paid speeches to Wall Street financiers, which she had refused to release, Podesta's emails with campaign staff, and correspondence between the Clinton campaign and DNC chair Donna Brazile regarding questions and topics to be raised at upcoming debates and events. After midnight and hours of outraged responses to the Access Hollywood tape spreading across the political spectrum, Trump released a videotaped apology. "I've never said I'm a perfect person. These words don't reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize. I pledge to be a better man tomorrow and will never, ever let you down. Let's be honest, we're living in the real world. This is nothing more than a distraction. Bill Clinton has actually abused women, and Hillary has bullied, attacked, shamed, and intimidated his victims. See you at the debate on Sunday." The Trump High Command assembled the next morning, Saturday, October 8th, in the penthouse of Trump Tower. Priebus told Bannon, "The donors are all out. Everybody's dropped. Paul Ryan's going to drop this afternoon." The loss of the money people and the Republican House Speaker signaled the end. "It's over," Priebus said. "What do you mean it's over?" Bannon said. "Everybody's pulling their endorsements. I don't even know if Pence is going to be on this thing." The fastidiously loyal Mike Pence, Trump's running mate, was doubting. "Are you fucking kidding me?" Bannon replied. "It's a tape, dude." "You don't understand," said Priebus. "It's over." The team gathered in Trump's residence. Trump sat in his big gold chair. "What's the percentages?" he asked. "Okay, let's go around. I really want to know, what's your recommendation? What's your advice?" "You have two choices," Priebus began. "You either drop out right now, or you're going to lose in the biggest landslide in American history and be humiliated for life. I'm getting crushed. I've got every leader, every congressman, every senator, everyone I care about on the Republican National Committee, they're going crazy. And they're telling me you're either going to lose big in a massive way or you need to drop out of the race. I can't make it any better." "Well," Trump said, "I'm glad we're starting off on a positive note." "Cut the bullshit," Bannon said to Priebus. "That's bullshit." "If you want to do it now," Priebus continued, Pence is prepared to step up, and Condi Rice will come in as his VP. Rice had been National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under George W. Bush. "That's never going to happen," Bannon said loudly. "That's ridiculous. Fucking absurd." In less than 2 months as campaign CEO, they had cut the polling gap in half with endless rallies. Trump was a rock star now. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was sitting in sweatpants and ball cap. "This is not about the campaign," Christie said with a note of finality. "That's over. This is about your brand. You've worked your entire life. These kids," he pointed to Trump's son Don Jr. and Jared Kushner, "you need to save the brand for them, or the brand's finished." Rudy Giuliani said that Trump now had less than a 50% chance of winning. "Basically, you've got 40%. "Do we call 60 minutes?" Kellyanne Conway asked. She proposed a public confessional. "You can't do it Sunday because the debate's on Sunday. Or you call ABC or NBC and have him on the sofa with Ivanka on one side and Melania on the other, basically crying, saying, 'I apologize.'" Melania Trump had come down and wandered behind the sofa where Conway was proposing they sit. It was clear she was seething. "Not doing that," Melania said in her Slovenian accent, dismissively waving her hand. "No way. No, no, no." Bannon believed she had the most influence with Trump of anyone, that she could discern who was sucking up and who was telling the truth. "Behind the scenes, she's a hammer." "What do you think?" Trump asked Bannon. 100%, Bannon said. 100% what?" asked Trump. 100% metaphysical certitude, you're going to win." He often declared certainty with 100%. "Cut the shit," Trump yelled. "I'm tired of the 100%. I need to know what you really think." Priebus didn't believe the 100% and thought no one in the room did. He saw that Trump was upset with himself. "It's 100%, Bannon repeated. Trump's words were locker room talk. "Your supporters will still be with you. They are worried about saving their country." The comparison with Bill Clinton was handy. "We're going to compare your talk with his action." Bill Clinton was as much Trump's opposition as Hillary, perhaps now more than ever. "How are we going to do that?" Trump asked. "Jared and I reserved the Hilton Hotel ballroom for 8 tonight. We're going to put it on Facebook and get 1,000 hammerheads, one of Bannon's terms for diehard Trump supporters, in red ball caps, and you're going to fucking do a rally and attack the media. We're going to double down. Fuck 'em, right?" Trump seemed delighted. The others were opposed. There was a huge fight, but a compromise emerged. Conway would call ABC and arrange for David Muir, the ABC anchor, to helicopter in. Giuliani and Christie would write an introduction for Trump, and Muir could do a 10-minute interview. Political suicide, thought Bannon. This would make the campaign over for sure, and Trump would lose by 20 points. He said they had to let the Hilton know about the rally because they would have to put up cash. Priebus said again that Trump just had to drop out. "You guys don't know what you're doing. You're going to go down." Prominent Republicans began to call for Trump to step aside for Mike Pence, who had been making campaign appearances in Ohio. He had gone to ground when the news broke about the Access Hollywood tape. Just before 1 p.m., Pence released a statement saying, "As a husband and a father, I was offended by the words and actions described by Donald Trump in the 11-year-old video released yesterday. I do not condone his remarks and cannot defend them. I am grateful that he has expressed remorse and apologized to the American people. We pray for his family and look forward to the opportunity he has to show what is in his heart when he goes before the nation tomorrow night." Stories circulated that Pence had given Bannon a sealed letter urging Trump to drop off the ticket. 2 hours later, Melania Trump released a statement. "The words my husband used are unacceptable and offensive to me. This does not represent the man that I know. He has the heart and mind of a leader. I hope people will accept his apology as I have and focus on the important issues facing our nation and the world. At 3:40 p.m., Trump tweeted, "The media and establishment want me out of the race so badly. I will never drop out of the race. Will never let my supporters down. Hashtag MAGA." Trump took a seat. Preparations for the ABC interview were in motion. It was likely to be a record breaker. Giuliani and Christie handed a sheet of their suggestions to Trump. Trump read, "My language was inappropriate, not acceptable for a president." It was political speak. Not Trump, all Giuliani and Christie. Trump was surly. "I can't do this," he said. "This is bullshit. This is weak. You guys are weak." Bannon realized he had this one. He just had to keep his mouth shut.
"Donald, you don't understand," Christie said.
"Donald, Donald, Donald," Giuliani said. "You've got to do this. Think about the suburban moms."
The clock was ticking. Bannon turned to Conway. "What do you do to kill this?"
"You can't kill it," she replied. "They're already here."
ABC and David Muir.
"What do you do to kill it?" Bannon repeated.
"All my credibility is on the line. You can't kill this thing. It's in motion. It's going to happen," Conway said.
"It's not going to happen," Bannon said. "He ain't going to do it."
"If he does do an introduction," Bannon continued, "you can't have him do a live interview. He'll fucking get cut to pieces."
The apology road was not Trump, and if he was questioned afterward, he would backtrack and contradict himself. They tried to reword it. Trump went through two lines.
"I'm not doing this."
The glass in Trump Tower was thick, but they could hear the roaring crowd of Trump supporters in the street, a riot of deplorables who had adopted Hillary Clinton's derisive term as their own.
"My people," Trump declared. "I'm going to go down. Don't worry about the rally. I'm going to do it right here."
"You're not going down there," a Secret Service agent insisted. "You're not going outside."
"I'm going downstairs," Trump said.
He headed out.
"This is great."
Conway tried to intervene.
"You just can't cancel on ABC.
"I don't care. I'm never doing this. It was a dumb idea. I never wanted to do it."
Bannon was about to follow Trump into the elevator when Christie said, "Hang on for a second." He stayed back as Trump went downstairs with Conway, Don Jr., and the Secret Service.
"You're the fucking problem," Christie said to Bannon. "You've been the problem since the beginning."
"What are you talking about?"
"You're the enabler. You play to every one of his worst instincts. This thing's over and you're going to be blamed. Every time he's got terrible instincts for these things and all you do is get him all worked up. This is going to be humiliating."
Christie was in Bannon's face, looming large. Bannon half wanted to say, "You fat fuck, let's throw down right here."
"Governor," he replied instead, "the plane leaves tomorrow."
They were heading to St. Louis for the second presidential debate.
"If you're on the plane, you're on the team."
Downstairs, the Secret Service relented. Trump could go out on the street, but only briefly. There could be weapons all over the place. It was a baying mob of supporters and protesters. At 4:30 p.m., Trump stepped out, giving high fives and shaking hands for a few minutes, flanked by the Secret Service and New York police.
"Will you stay in the race?" a reporter asked.
100%, Trump said. Everyone on the Trump campaign refused to appear on the Sunday morning talk shows except Rudy Giuliani. Priebus, Christie, even the reliable, thick-armored, never-say-no Conway had been scheduled. All canceled. Giuliani appeared on all five, completing what is called a full Ginsburg, a term in honor of William H. Ginsburg, the attorney for Monica Lewinsky, who appeared on all five network Sunday programs on February 1, 1998. Giuliani gave, or tried to give, the same spiel on each show. Trump's words had been reprehensible and terrible and awful, and he had apologized. Trump was not the same man now that he had been when captured on tape in 2005. The transformational presidential campaign had made him a changed man. And besides, Hillary Clinton's speeches to Goldman Sachs, which had come out in WikiLeaks' release of John Podesta's emails, revealed a private coziness with Wall Street that clashed with her liberal public positions. The country would view that much more harshly. Bannon, not a regular viewer of Sunday talk shows, tuned in. The morning was a brutal slog. When CNN's Jake Tapper said Trump's words had been a depiction of sexual assault that was really offensive on just a basic human level, Giuliani had to acknowledge, "Yes, it is." Giuliani was exhausted, practically bled out, but he had proved his devotion and friendship. He had pulled out every stop, leaning frequently and heavily on his Catholicism. "You confess your sins, and you make a firm resolution not to commit that sin again. And then the priest gives you absolution, and then, hopefully, you're a changed person. I mean, we believe the people in this country can change." Giuliani, seeming punch drunk, made it to the plane for the departure to the St. Louis debate. He took a seat next to Trump, who was at his table in his reading glasses. He peered over at the former mayor. "Rudy, you're a baby," Trump said loudly. "I've never seen a worse defense of me in my life. They took your diaper off right there. You're like a little baby that needed to be changed. When are you going to be a man?" Trump turned to the others, particularly Bannon. "Why did you put him on? He can't defend me. I need somebody to defend me. Where are my people?" "What are you talking about?" Bannon asked. "This guy's the only guy that went on." "I don't want to hear it," Trump replied. "It was a mistake. He shouldn't have gone on. He's weak. You're weak, Rudy. You've lost it." Giuliani just looked up, his face blank. Shortly after the planned departure, Chris Christie had not appeared. "Fuck this guy," Bannon said, and the plane took off. Chapter 5. Giuliani had said twice on CNN and NBC that he did not anticipate Trump going after Bill Clinton or Hillary's private life in the debate that evening. But Bannon had arranged what he thought would be a well-timed kill shot. Four of the women who claimed Clinton had attacked them or Hillary had tried to undermine would be at the debate, Bannon explained to Trump. They were Paula Jones, who said Clinton had exposed himself to her, and with whom Clinton had settled a sexual harassment suit, paying her $850,000. Juanita Broderick, who claimed Clinton had raped her. Kathleen Willey, who alleged that Clinton sexually assaulted her in the White House. And Kathy Shelton, who, when she was 12, alleged that Hillary had smeared her while defending her client, who allegedly had raped Shelton. It was an Oscar list from Clinton's past, triggering memories of his steamy Arkansas and White House years. Prior to the debate, Bannon said, they would sit the four women at a table with Trump and invite in reporters. "That fucking media, they think they're going to come in for the end of debate prep, and we're going to let them in the room, and the women will be there, and we'll just go live. Boom!" Scorched earth, just the way Bannon liked it. Trump had been tweeting links to Breitbart stories about the Clinton accusers throughout the day. "I like it," Trump said, standing and looking imperial. "I like it." Just before 7:30 p.m., reporters entered the room at the St. Louis Four Seasons where Trump and the women were waiting. Bannon and Kushner stood in the back of the room, grinning. At 7:26, Trump tweeted, "Join me on hashtag Facebook Live as I conclude my final hashtag debate preparations." Effectively live broadcasting events as CNN picked up his feed. The women breathed fire into the microphones.
Actions speak louder than words, Juanita Broderick said. Mr. Trump may have said some bad words, but Bill Clinton raped me and Hillary Clinton threatened me.
The debate organizers barred the Clinton accusers from sitting in the VIP family box right in front of the stage as Bannon had planned, so they walked in last and sat in the front row of the audience. Early on, CNN's Anderson Cooper, the debate co-host, raised the Access Hollywood tape, saying, "That is sexual assault. You bragged that you have sexually assaulted women. Do you understand that?" Trump parried. "When we have a world where you have ISIS chopping off heads, where you have wars and horrible, horrible sights all over, and you have so many bad things happening, yes, I am very embarrassed by it and I hate it, but it's locker room talk, and it's one of those things. I will knock the hell out of ISIS." A short time later, Trump said, "If you look at Bill Clinton, far worse. Mine are words, and his was action. There's never been anybody in the history of politics in this nation who's been so abusive to women." Then Trump announced that Kathy Shelton and Paula Jones were in the audience and said, "When Hillary talks about words that I said 11 years ago, I think it's disgraceful, and I think she should be ashamed of herself." ABC's Martha Raddatz, the co-moderator, had to step in to ask the audience to hold their applause so that Hillary Clinton could speak. Bossie, now Bannon's deputy campaign manager, was involved in the day-to-day management and hundreds of daily decisions and quickly learned who had the real authority. He would be in a meeting with Bannon, Conway, and Kushner where a decision would be made, for example, on the next three TV spots. Bossie would pass the decision to the person running digital ads, but then see that they didn't run. "What the hell?" he said. "I came in here. I told you what to do. We had a meeting. We decided." "Oh, no, no," he would be told. "Jared came in after you and said, don't do that." This was a very important light bulb moment. If Kushner didn't fully buy in, things wouldn't get done. So, after decision meetings, Bossie approached Kushner to make sure he understood what Jared wanted. Kushner, without the title, was running the campaign, especially on money matters. He knew that his father-in-law considered it all his money, and Jared had to sign off on everything. Kushner scoffed at Bannon's suggestion that Trump put $50 million of his own money into his presidential campaign. "He will never write a $50 million check," Kushner told Bannon in August. "Dude," Bannon said, "we're going to have this thing in a dead heat." They would soon be tied with Hillary. "We need to finally go up on TV with something." They needed to contribute to the ground game. "We're going to need at least $50 million. He's going to have to write it." Under election rules and law, the candidate can make unlimited personal contributions to his or her own campaign. "He'll never do it," Kushner insisted. "It's about being president of the United States." "Steve, unless you can show him he's a dead lock, a certain winner, I mean a dead lock, up 3 to 5 points, he'll never write that size check." "Well, you're right," Bannon agreed. "Maybe we can get $25 million out of him," said Kushner, adding a caveat. "He doesn't have a lot of cash." After the final presidential debate in Las Vegas on October 19th, Trump returned to New York. It was now the 3-week sprint to Election Day. Bannon, Kushner, and Mnuchin, the former Goldman Sachs executive, presented Trump with a plan for him to give $25 million to the campaign. "No way," Trump said. "Fuck that, I'm not doing it." "Where were the famous Republican high donor guys? Where the fuck's the money? Where's all this money from these guys? Jared, you're supposed to be raising all this money. Not going to do it." The next day they came up with a new proposal for $10 million and presented it to Trump on his plane. This wouldn't even be a loan, but an advance against the cash donations coming in from supporters. These were the Grundoons, or hobbits, as Bannon playfully and derisively called them, and he had a deadline. They had to have the $10 million that day. The supporters' donations will keep coming in, win, lose, or draw, Bannon said. But I say you're going to win. You don't know that, Trump snapped. We're 3 points down. It showed how little confidence Trump had in victory, Bannon thought. After 2 days of pushing for the $10 million, Trump finally told them, "Okay, fine, get off my back. We'll do $10 million. Steve Mnuchin handed Trump two documents to sign. The first was a terms sheet outlining how he would be paid back as money came into the campaign. "What's this?" Trump asked about the second document. "Wiring instructions." Mnuchin knew that every Trump decision was tentative and open to relitigation. Nothing was ever over. "What the fuck?" said Trump. "The wire order should be sent to someone in the Trump Organization." Mnuchin said no, it needed to be done right then. Trump signed both documents. Money questions ignited Trump. When he learned that Christie, who would be the head of his transition team, was raising money for the operation, he summoned him and Bannon to Trump Tower. "Where the fuck is the money?" Trump asked Christie. "I need money for my campaign. I'm putting money in my campaign, and you're fucking stealing from me." He saw it all as his. Christie defended his efforts. This was for the required transition organization in case Trump won. Trump said that Mitt Romney had spent too much time on transition meetings as the nominee in 2012 and not enough time on campaign events. "That's why he lost. You're jinxing me," he told Christie. "I don't want a transition. I'm shutting down the transition. I told you from day one it was just an honorary title. You're jinxing me. I'm not going to spend a second on it." "Whoa," Bannon interjected. "A transition might make sense." "It's jinxing me," Trump said. "I can't have one." "Okay, let's do this," Bannon said. "I'll shut the whole thing down. What do you think Morning Joe's going to say tomorrow? You've got a lot of confidence you're going to be president, right?" Trump agreed, finally and reluctantly, to a slimmed-down, skeletal version of the transition. Christie would cease fundraising. "He can have his transition," Trump said, "but I don't want anything to do with it." 2 weeks before the election, October 25, 2016, I was in Fort Worth, Texas, giving a speech to about 400 executives from a firm called Key to Act that provides construction and field service management software. My topic was the age of the American presidency. What will 2016 bring? The group was mostly white and was from all over the country. I asked for a show of hands. How many expected to vote for Hillary? At best, I could tell there were only about 10. How many expected to vote for Trump? Half the room raised their hands, approximately 200. Wow, I thought. That seemed like a lot of Trump voters. After the speech, the CEO of the firm approached. "I need to sit down," he said, taking a chair near where I was standing. He was breathing heavily. "I'm flabbergasted. I have worked with these people every day for more than a year. I know them. I know their families. If you had told me that 200 planned to vote for Trump, I would have told you that is impossible." He said he would have expected more or less an even split. But 200? He was astonished. He offered no explanation, and I certainly did not have one. 10 days before the election, Trump flew to North Carolina, a must-win state. He was down several points in most national polls. The NBC Wall Street Journal poll had him down 6 points. Bannon spoke with Congressman Mark Meadows, who represented the 11th District. Meadows was a Tea Party favorite and the chairman of the powerful Freedom Caucus of about 30 conservative and libertarian Republicans. He was a big Trump supporter. Over the summer, he had led rally attendees in their favorite anti-Clinton chant, "Lock her up." "Of all the battleground states," Bannon told Meadows, "this is the one that worries me the most." The campaign seemed not to be clicking.
Meadows disagreed.
The evangelicals are out. They're ringing doorbells. I'm telling you, you do not need to come back to North Carolina. We've got this.
Meadows' wife and other conservative women had chartered a bus after the Access Hollywood tape and traveled across the state urging women to vote for Trump. Everything was holding and getting better, Meadows said. Meadows had big plans to oust Speaker Paul Ryan. He handed Bannon a folder.
Read this, he said. Some 24 hours after Trump wins, we call the question on Ryan and he's finished. We take over the House of Representatives, and then we have a real revolution.
Bannon was still worried, though he saw some positives in the Trump-Pence strategy. They were using Pence well, Bannon believed, running him essentially on a circuit of states, at least 23 appearances in Pennsylvania, 25 in Ohio, 22 in North Carolina, 15 in Iowa, 13 in Florida, 8 in Michigan, 7 in Wisconsin. The theme was for Pence to campaign as if he were running for governor of those states, focusing on local issues and what a President Trump in Washington could do for the state.
And every now and then we'd pull him, Pence, out to Jesus land, Bannon said.
Trump, he said, was essentially running as county supervisor in 41 large population centers. Bannon was amazed that the Clinton campaign did not use President Obama strategically. Obama had won Iowa in 2008 and 2012 by 6 to 10 points. He never goes. Clinton never went to Wisconsin in the general election. She didn't talk enough about the economy.
When I saw her go to Arizona, I said, "They've lost their fucking minds," Bannon said. "What are they doing?"
Historians will write books in the coming years trying to answer that question and related 2016 campaign matters. I was planning on writing a book on the first year or two of the next president. It seemed likely that would be Hillary Clinton, but Fort Worth gave me pause. 2 days before the election, November 6th, I appeared on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. The discussion turned to the possibility that Trump would win. According to the transcript, I said on the show, "If Trump does win, how is that possible? What's been missed?" And I think I find in travels around the country, talking to groups from Texas to Florida to New York, people don't trust the polls, and they look at voting as much more personal. They don't like the idea, "Oh, I'm in a demographic group, so I'm going to go this way." They want to decide themselves. Wallace asked if I thought that meant people were lying to the pollsters. "I think that's quite possible," I said. But I didn't see any signal or have any inside information. I was far from understanding what was going on. The day before Election Day, Trump made a 5-state swing, including North Carolina. He was exhausted. "If we don't win," he said at a rally in Raleigh, "I will consider this the single greatest waste of time, energy, and money. If we don't win, all of us, honestly, we've all wasted our time." It was an odd thing to say, seemingly a downer, but the crowd appeared to love it and took it as motivational. One of Clinton's last rallies was at Philadelphia's Independence Hall, where tens of thousands gathered on November 7th. President Obama was there. According to Clinton's book, he hugged her and whispered to her, "You've got this. I'm so proud." About 5 p.m. on Election Day, Trump received the latest exit polls. They were brutal. Tied in Ohio and Iowa, down 9 in Pennsylvania, down 7 in North Carolina. "There's nothing else we could have done," Trump told Bannon. "We left it all on the field." On election night, it was remarkable to watch the needle on the live forecast dial on the New York Times website, which started out giving Clinton an 85% chance of winning. But the dial began to swing swiftly toward Trump. A good sign for Trump was North Carolina. African American and Latino turnout was down. The state was called for Trump at 11:11 p.m.
It was announced he had won Ohio at 10:36 p.m., Florida at 10:50 p.m., and Iowa at 12:02 a.m. President Obama sent a message to Hillary Clinton that he was concerned that another uncertain election outcome, as had happened in the 2000 presidential election, would be bad for the country. If she was going to lose, she should concede quickly and with grace. The AP called Wisconsin for Trump at 2:29 a.m. and declared him the winner. "Donald, it's Hillary," Clinton began her concession phone call shortly afterward. Trump went to speak to the crowd at the New York Hilton in Midtown Manhattan, a few blocks from Trump Tower. "Now it's time for Americans to bind the wounds of division," he said in remarks right out of a good government playbook. "I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans. As I've said from the beginning, ours was not a campaign, but rather an incredible and great movement comprised of Americans from all races, religions, backgrounds, and beliefs. We must reclaim our country's destiny and dream big and bold and daring. We will seek common ground, not hostility. Partnership, not conflict." He thanked his family, Conway, Bannon, Alabama Republican Senator Jeff Sessions, great man, who had given Trump an early endorsement, and General Michael Flynn, a retired Army general and national security advisor to the campaign. Flynn had forged an extraordinarily close relationship with Trump. The president-elect dwelled on Priebus. "Reince is a superstar. But I said, they can't call you a superstar, Reince, unless you win. Reince, come up here." He located Priebus in the audience and summoned him to the stage. Priebus stumbled up from the crowd. "Say a few words," Trump said. "No, come on, say something." "Ladies and gentlemen," Priebus said, "the next president of the United States, Donald Trump." "Amazing guy," Trump said. And, as if he fully understood what the RNC had done for him, all the money, the workers, the volunteers, the canvassing, added, "Our partnership with the RNC was so important to the success and what we've done." He closed by saying, "It's been an amazing 2-year period, and I love this country." Bannon was convinced that Trump himself was stunned. "He has no earthly idea he's going to win," Bannon said later, and he had done no preparation. "He never thought he would lose, but he didn't think he would win. There's a difference. And you've got to remember, no preparation, no transition team." Putin called from Russia with congratulations, as did President Xi Jinping from China. Many other world leaders called. "It's finally dawning on him," Bannon recalled, "that this is the real deal. This is a guy totally unprepared. Hillary Clinton spent her entire adult life getting ready for this moment. Trump hasn't spent a second getting ready for this moment." After a few hours of sleep, Bannon started flipping through the transition documents. Garbage supreme, he thought. For Secretary of Defense, they listed some big campaign donor from New Hampshire. Unbelievable. Now there were 4,000 jobs to fill. He realized they would have to at least temporarily embrace the establishment. Perhaps a better word would be fleece. Pluck off some people who knew something. "Give me the executive director of this thing," Bannon ordered, seeking some connection with whatever transition apparatus existed. "Get him in my office immediately." He didn't remember his name. Bannon reached the director's office. "Can he come in?" he asked. "It's going to be tough." "Why?" "He's in the Bahamas." "This is the island of misfit toys," Bannon said. "How the fuck are we going to put together a government? We relieve the watch in 10 weeks at noon. We've got to be up and running." Priebus and Bannon were now going to share top staff power. They worked out an unusual arrangement. Bannon would be Chief Strategist, a new title and idea. Priebus would be White House Chief of Staff.
The press release listed Bannon first, which Priebus agreed to in order to keep Bannon from being chief of staff, traditionally listed at the top. Chapter 6. A week after the election, President-elect Trump invited retired four-star Army General Jack Keane to Trump Tower for an interview to become Secretary of Defense. "You're my number one guy," Trump said. Keane, 73, a regular on Fox News and a close advisor to former Vice President Dick Cheney, declined. Financial debts from taking care of his wife, who had recently died, made accepting impossible. In an hour-long meeting, he gave Trump a tour of the world and offered some advice. "Mr. President-elect," he said, "Congress, public opinion, and your cabinet will be involved with your domestic agenda. In national security and foreign policy, this is really your lane. The world's problems have a way of coming to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, whether you want them or not. Mistakes on the domestic side have a correcting mechanism. You can get a do-over. There are no do-overs in national security. When we make mistakes, it has huge consequences." He thought President Obama had been too timid in a dangerous world. "By our actions, or lack of actions, we can actually destabilize part of the world and cause enormous problems," Keane warned. Trump asked who he would recommend as Secretary of Defense. "For practical purposes," Keane said, "Jim Mattis." He was the retired four-star Marine general whom Obama had sacked as central commander in the Middle East. Obama had relieved Mattis in 2013 because he was thought to be hawkish and too eager to confront Iran militarily. "He's a good man, Mattis, isn't he?" Trump said. He had heard of the general, whose nicknames were Mad Dog and Chaos. "Yes, sir," Keane said. "He's a good man." "There are advantages to Mattis," he added. "He's very current. So if we have major problems on our hands, you've got a guy that can roll up his sleeves on day one and get after these problems. That's number one. Number two, he's very experienced, particularly in the most volatile neighborhood in the world, in the Middle East. And he's a very experienced combat veteran in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And highly regarded inside the military, but also highly regarded outside. What's not obvious is how thoughtful he is," Keane said, "and how deliberate he is." "What do you mean?" Trump asked. "He thinks things through. He spends time thinking through the problem." Mattis had not married, and he read books all the time. He had 7,000 books in his library. Also known as the warrior monk, he had been totally devoted to the military with more than 4 decades of service. He was single-minded, but calm. "I have a lot of respect for him," Keane said. "He's a man of courage and a man of integrity." Back in his car, Keane punched in Mattis's number. He explained that Trump had asked him first, and he had said no. Mattis seemed to want assurances. "You can't do this, Jack?" Mattis said. "No, I can't," Keane said. "Jim, you can do it, can't you?" "Yeah, Jack," Mattis replied. "They seem to have their minds set on a military person to do it because of the challenges they're facing." Later in November, Trump invited Mattis, 66, to Bedminster. Mattis's quiet presence was imposing. "We have to take care of ISIS," Trump emphasized. The Islamic State had grown out of the remains of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and expanded brutally into Syria with the ambition of establishing and ruling as a caliphate. Trump had promised to defeat ISIS in the campaign, and the threat was growing. Mattis looked directly at Trump. "We need to change what we are doing," he said. "It can't be a war of attrition. It must be a war of annihilation." Trump loved the concept. Perfect. He offered Mattis the job, though they agreed not to announce it right away. Bannon considered Mattis too liberal on social policies and a globalist at heart, but the connection Trump and Mattis had made was central. Mattis was both a warrior and comforter. Bannon soon was calling him the Secretary of Assurance and the moral center of gravity of the administration. At Bedminster, Bannon arranged to make the photo shoots of candidates being interviewed look like 10 Downing Street as Trump and visitors walked through the large door. "It'll be perfect," he told Trump. "We'll put the media across the street, and you'll meet and greet like a British prime minister." The photograph that ran in many newspapers was Trump and Mattis in front of the door, Trump's fingers joined in the air, Mattis, with his perfect marine posture, erect, the quiet general. As a colonel, Mattis had taken the Marines into Afghanistan after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Navy captain and SEAL for 17 years Bob Harward had led the SEALs in. "Hey, want to go together?" Mattis had asked Harward in 2001. In the dozen years that followed, Harward had major assignments under Mattis. In the summer of 2013, now a vice admiral, Harward was sent to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida to become deputy central commander to Mattis. He checked into the BOQ, bachelor officer quarters, worked a day, and went back to his room. All his belongings had been moved out. He was told everything had been moved to General Mattis's house. Harward went over to the house. He walked into the kitchen and found General Mattis there folding Harward's underwear. "Sir," Harward said, "what the fuck are you doing?" "I did my laundry," Mattis said. "I figured I'd do yours too." Harward found Mattis the most gracious, humble officer he had ever served under. Rather than introduce Harward as my deputy, Mattis said, "I want you to meet my co-commander." When Harward retired and moved to the Middle East as the chief executive of Lockheed Martin in the United Arab Emirates, he kept in touch with Mattis. Mattis worried about the effects of the Obama administration's failure to deter Iran. "But if you know Jim Mattis," Harward said, "he's not a fan of going to war." In Marine lore, Iran had inflicted a wound on the Corps that had never healed and had not been answered. Iran had been behind the terrorist bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983. The attack killed 220 Marines, one of the largest single-day death tolls in the history of the Corps. Another 21 U.S. servicemen died, bringing the toll to 241, the largest terrorist attack against the U.S. before 9/11. Mattis had been a Marine Corps officer for 11 years and was a major. As CENTCOM commander from 2010 to 2013, according to one senior aide, Mattis believed that Iran remained the greatest threat to the United States' interests in the Middle East. He was concerned that the Israelis were going to strike the Iranian nuclear facilities and pull the United States into the conflict. Mattis also believed the United States did not have enough military force in the region and did not have robust rules of engagement. He wrote a memo to President Obama through Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta seeking more authority to respond to Iranian provocations. He was worried that the Iranians might mine international waters and create an incident at sea that could escalate. Tom Donilon, the National Security Advisor, answered Mattis. A memo, soon referred to as the Donilon Memo, directed that under no circumstances would Mattis take any action against Iran for mining international waters unless the mine was effectively dropped in the path of a U.S. warship and presented an imminent danger to the ship. The Donilon Memo would be one of the first orders Mattis rescinded when he became Secretary of Defense. Mattis continued to beat the drum on Iran. He found the war plan for Iran insufficient. It was all aviation dependent, all air power. It did not have a broad joint force plan. The plan had five strike options. First, against small Iranian boats, another against ballistic missiles, another against other weapons systems, and another for an invasion. Strike option 5 was the plan for destroying the Iranian nuclear program. Mattis wrote a scathing memo to the chief of naval operations saying, "Your navy is completely unprepared for conflict in the Persian Gulf." Panetta told Mattis his stance on Iran put him in real trouble with the Obama White House. "Give me something to counter that perception," he asked. "I get paid to give my best military advice," Mattis replied. "They make the policy decisions. I'm not going to change what I think to placate them. If I don't have their confidence, then I go." And go he did. Mattis was relieved 5 months early, and when he left in March 2013, he shredded what he called a big smart book, almost a foot thick, containing all his key memos, documents, notes, issue summaries, and memory joggers. For someone who reveled in history, he didn't choose to keep any of it for others. As part of his end-of-tour report, Mattis attached a 15-page strategy for Iran because he didn't believe the Obama administration had one. Though he noted that Obama had made several statements on Iran, Mattis remarked, "Presidential speeches are not a policy." His draft strategy focused on confronting and not tolerating Iran's destabilizing actions through Hezbollah, the Quds Force operations, and their actions in Iraq to undermine the U.S. It was designed to reestablish U.S. military credibility. The second part was a long-term engagement plan to shape Iranian public opinion. With Mattis out the door, no one cared about his views on Iran. When he was nominated as secretary, there was a sudden run on the plan, and copies could not be made fast enough. The question was, did Mattis's appointment as Secretary of Defense in a hawkish Trump presidency mean a likely military conflict with Iran? At the suggestion of former Secretary of State James A. Baker III and former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Trump met with Rex Tillerson, 64, the CEO of Exxon for the past decade. Trump was impressed with the native Texan's confidence. He had a big presence. Tillerson had spent 40 years at Exxon and was untainted by government experience. Here was a man who saw the world through the lens of deal-making and globe-trotting, a businessman who had negotiated oil contracts worldwide, including billions with Russia. Putin had awarded Tillerson the Russian Order of Friendship in 2013. In December, Trump thumbed his nose at the Washington political world but embraced the business establishment and named Tillerson as his Secretary of State, the top cabinet post. Trump told aides that Tillerson looked the part he would play on the world stage. "A very Trumpian-inspired pick," Kellyanne Conway said on television, promising big impact. Chapter 7. Jared Kushner invited Gary Cohn, the president of Goldman Sachs, to come talk to his father-in-law on November 30th about the economy. A meeting was arranged for Cohn at Trump Tower. Cohn was a legendary risk-taker at the premier investment banking firm. He had an ego and sureness to match Trump's. He was advised that Trump routinely kept meetings to 10 minutes. In Trump's office were Bannon, Priebus, Kushner, and Steve Mnuchin, also a former Goldman banker and hedge fund manager who had been Trump's chief fundraiser during the last 6 months of the campaign. Mnuchin had been rewarded with the cabinet post of Treasury Secretary, though the appointment had not yet been announced. "The American economy overall is in okay shape," Cohn told Trump, "but it was ready to experience a growth explosion if certain actions were taken. To achieve this, the economy needed tax reform and the removal of the shackles of overregulation." Cohn knew this was what Trump wanted to hear. Then the New York City Democrat told the president-elect something he did not want to hear. "We're a trade-based economy," he said. "Free, fair, and open trade was essential." Trump had campaigned against international trade deals. "Second, the United States is an immigration center to the world. We've got to continue to have open borders," Cohn said. The employment picture was so favorable that the United States would run out of workers soon. So, immigration had to continue.
We have many jobs in this country that Americans won't do.
Next, Cohn repeated what everyone was saying. Interest rates were going to go up over the foreseeable future.
I agree, Trump said. We should just go borrow a lot of money right now, hold it, and then sell it and make money.
Cohn was astounded at Trump's lack of basic understanding. He tried to explain. If you, as the federal government, borrow money through issuing bonds, you are increasing the U.S. deficit.
What do you mean? Trump asked. Just run the presses. Print money.
You don't get to do it that way, Cohn said. We have huge deficits, and they matter. The government doesn't keep a balance sheet like that.
If you want to do something that would be smart, and you actually do control this, I would add a 50-year and a 100-year bond from the U.S. Treasury.
With interest rates going down in recent years, Treasury had brought the duration of bonds down to 10 years as much as possible. That was the right thing to do, Cohn said. With rates increasing, the insurance companies and the pensions will lend the government money for 50 years or 100 years, and you could probably do it at 3.75%. That would be really cheap money over the next 50 to 100 years.
Wow, Trump said. That's a great idea.
He turned to Mnuchin. Can we do that?
Oh, sure, the designated Treasury Secretary said. We can absolutely do that.
Do you agree with him? Trump asked.
Yeah, I agree with him, Mnuchin said.
You've been working for me 6 months, Trump said. Why the hell have you never talked to me about this? Why is he the first person to ever tell me that?
There was nothing in the world that was then yielding 3.75% risk-free, Cohn said. There would be a run on these bonds and plenty of buyers. The 50-year corporate bond was selling all over the place. Investors wanted high, risk-free yield. Turning to the Federal Reserve, Cohn noted that the U.S. had had an effective zero interest rate for years. There was only one way to go. Interest rates would go up for two reasons. The economy was getting much stronger, and higher rates would tamp down inflation.
So if I'm running the Fed, I'm going to raise rates, he said.
Trump knew that presidents liked low rates to help the economy. He said,
Well, I'm not going to choose you to run the Fed, ever.
That's fine, Cohn said. It's the worst job in America. Turning to taxes, Cohn said,
The 35% corporate tax rate has been great for my business for the last decade. We've been inverting companies to 10% tax jurisdictions, and they pay us enormous fees.
He was speaking as a Goldman president. An inversion refers to relocating a corporation's legal home to a low-tax country such as Ireland or Bermuda in the form of a new parent company while retaining operations and management as a subsidiary in the higher-tax country. Goldman had facilitated dozens of companies' moves abroad. The company's leaders and boards had a responsibility to shareholders to maximize profits, and moving, inverting, dramatically raised earnings. Nearly all the drug makers and insurance companies had moved. Cohn bragged,
Where else can I take a company doing X in business that does X tomorrow and has 20% more earnings just by changing their corporate headquarters?
Arguing against Goldman's self-interest, Cohn added,
We can't allow that to happen. We've got to get our corporate tax in line with the average, which is about 21-22%.
Though there had been some restrictions imposed by Congress, there were ways to skirt the new laws. We can't allow companies to just keep inverting out of the United States. It's just bad. It's wrong for business. It's wrong for jobs. I'm talking against my business. We made a ton of money. Trump returned to printing money.
We'll just borrow, he said, enamored with the idea of heading the federal government, which had the best credit rating in the world, so they could borrow at the lowest interest rate.
Cohn didn't mention a report that had come out during the campaign, which said the Trump Organization's business credit score was a 19 out of 100, below the national average by 30 points, and that it had trouble borrowing money.
You just can't print money, Cohn said.
Why not?
Why not?
Congress had a debt ceiling which set a cap on how much money the federal government could borrow, and it was legally binding. It was clear that Trump did not understand the way the U.S. government debt cycle balance sheet worked. Inflation would probably be steady. Automation was coming, Cohn said. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics. We'll manage the labor supply more efficiently now than we ever did in the history of mankind. So look, you're in the most precarious time in terms of job losses. We now can create labor with machines. If you're here 8 years, you're going to deal with the automation of the automobile and truck. About 25% of the U.S. population makes a living driving something. Think about that. What are you talking about? Trump asked. With the self-driving autonomous vehicle, millions of people are going to have to re-enter the workforce in different jobs. That would be a big change and possible large disruption. I want you to come work for me, Trump said. Doing what? Trump mentioned Deputy Secretary of Defense. First of all, I don't want to be Deputy Secretary of anything, Cohn said. How about Director of National Intelligence? Cohn indicated no. He was not sure what the job did. He later learned it entailed overseeing the CIA and all the other intelligence agencies. You trade commodities, Trump said. Why don't you think about being Secretary of Energy? No interest. Trump tried to convince Cohn to become director of the Office of Management and Budget. No. Cohn knew it was a horrible job. You know what? Trump said at the end of what had become an hour-long meeting. I hired the wrong guy for Treasury Secretary. You should be Treasury Secretary. You would be the best Treasury Secretary. Mnuchin, right there, didn't say a thing or show any reaction. Come back and tell me what you want, Trump said. You'd be great to have on the team. It'd be fantastic. 5 minutes later, while Cohn was still in the building, he saw television flash breaking news. President-elect Trump has selected Steve Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. That's crazy, Jared said. Mnuchin, just put that out. You freaked him out so badly in the meeting. Cohn did some homework and spoke with other former Goldman executives who had worked in government. Robert Rubin, who had been head of the White House National Economic Council, NEC, for Clinton, and later Secretary of the Treasury, said that if Cohn could get the director of the National Economic Council job with a pledge he would be the chief economic czar, then he should take it. Being there in the West Wing was an enormous advantage if he had an agreement with the president. Cohn's wife, Lisa, said he should do it because he owed the country a great deal. You're too slow, you're too fat, and too old to serve your country any other way. Cohn returned to see Trump and expressed his interest in the NEC job as long as any economic business ran through him. It was the equivalent portfolio in economic matters to the National Security Advisor in foreign policy. Of course, Trump said. It'll be however you want it to run. We're going to do such great things. Priebus, who was in the meeting, worried about the on-the-spot hires. He later said to Trump, We're going to hire the guy, a Democrat who voted for Hillary Clinton, to run our economic council? Why? Shouldn't we talk about this? I'm sure he's really smart. Shouldn't we have a conversation before we offer a job like this? Oh, Trump said. We don't need to talk about it. Besides, the job had been offered and accepted. He's going to be great. The day after Christmas 2016, I reached Michael Flynn, Trump's newly designated National Security Advisor, by telephone. He was on vacation in Florida visiting his grandchildren. Flynn, a controversial retired three-star general and intelligence specialist, had been by Trump's side during the campaign as foreign policy advisor. At the Republican National Convention, he enthusiastically led the crowds in lock-her-up chants about Hillary Clinton. He later apologized. Obama had removed Flynn from head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2014 for management failures. And after the campaign, Trump had ignored advice from Obama not to take Flynn as his national security advisor. I called Flynn to get his take on Russia.
Several intelligence and Pentagon officials had told me that Russia had moved in recent years to modernize and improve their nuclear capability with a new submarine-launched ballistic missile and two new ICBMs.
"Yes, exactly," Flynn said on the record.
Under Putin's direction in the last 7 or 8 years, he said, Russia had not outmatched the United States, but had outsmarted us. He said he had begun talking to Trump about the Russian buildup 18 months before in 2015 when they had first met. He said that they agreed that the United States had given up too much of its capability, training, readiness, and modernization. Putin, he said, had, in a systematic way, upgraded not only his nuclear forces, but his tactical, conventional, and special forces.
If Russia became an adversary and we went toe-to-toe with them, we'd face the reality of Putin using innovation, technology, and sheer effort.
Flynn then spoke openly about the possibility the United States might have to begin testing nuclear weapons. The last U.S. test had been in 1992.
We are going to have to decide if we test again, he said.
The computer tests might not be sufficient, and it was important to see if the weapons worked.
My counsel to the boss, I said we are going to have to devote time, energy, and resources to this.
He said Trump's plan was to talk and act tough, send a shot across the bow of Putin.
He added, we will be leaning on the Reagan playbook. Be aggressive, and then negotiate.
We have to make it clear at the same time that we'll deal with Russia. You can't just have one view of Russia. Flynn was being widely criticized for going to Russia to speak for $33,750 from the Russian state-owned television network in 2015. He said it was an opportunity, and he got to meet Putin. Anyone would go, he said. Flynn did a question-and-answer session in Moscow. He made a standard plea for better U.S. relations to defeat ISIS, the importance of defining the enemy and not trying to just contain ISIS as Obama had done. Overall, on foreign policy, Flynn told me,
the president-elect is taking on this plate of shit throughout the world. The world is a mess. There's lots of cleaning up to do.